Good evening. Trying to tell you this evening a long story in a short time. So it'll be highlighted and looking forward to questions and comments afterwards. All of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Francis Drake. I'm not going to give you a long biography of Drake today. I should note, however, that he's a very remarkable personality. It's not just what he did, it's often how he did it. Not only going around the world, the first captain to successfully take a ship around the world, Magellan, after all, having died in the Philippines, but also the way he treated people, the way he handled his own crew. He, among other things, on his great Pacific raid, saw to it there were no Spanish lives lost in a very brutal time. He treated his prisoners well. Of course, it also paid off for him because they talked a great deal, especially if they were Manila Galleon pilots. That was fairly useful. But there was much more to it than that. He's just an interesting person. And to follow up on his work in the Pacific has been very interesting through the years. Now, let's start out with one of the many, many myths about Drake in the Pacific and along our coast, and that is that there's not much information. Now, that's completely false. It's the second best expedition records that exist for the 16th century. There are pages and pages and pages of descriptions. The one account alone has 13 pages about Drake at his landing here out in California. There are about a dozen different written sources. There are various maps and charts. There's a drawing, which I'll get to in a little while. So this is well documented. It's simply a question of using those documents in 16th century terms. The most important of these documents, but by no means the only one, is The World Encompassed, which was published well after Drake's death from the notes of Drake's chaplain and having been edited by Drake himself before his death. And it has remarkable details in it about many aspects of the voyage and particularly about the way of life here on the shore of Nova Albion, as Drake called it, including very detailed descriptions of the Native Americans. Obviously, the chaplain was fascinated by these characters. So, now, first of all, we need to understand what the ship was like. How did he get here? What was a ship like in the 16th century? One of our people, Raymond Acre, Captain Raymond Acre, spent much of a lifetime studying the 16th century ships. And he's the one who eventually drew the plans and built the model, which you can see in the visitor center now, in the theater of the visitor center a few miles away from here. This is the only portrait of the Golden Hind, about 2 inches long. And yet, it's quite good enough to give you the basics. And the ships of that period were rather similar. So it was possible for Ray Acre to take information from ships in general, plus the specifics of the Golden Hind. And there are specifics. We know how much water she drew. We know a lot of details about the ship. There are no plans at this period, so you can't expect that. And he was able to do this reconstruction. And this is Raymond Acre's cutaway model, 8-foot-long cutaway model of the Golden Hind. What was it like to live and work aboard a ship like this? Well, Ray showed us. Let's start with the fact that she has the usual 6-sail rig of that period. She has her tall bow and stern castles. These are fighting castles. These were the battles of those days were often fought board to board. The ships would slam into each other and they'd fight it out hand to hand across the decks. Sometimes, particularly at this period, they were beginning to use the big cannon more, and Drake and his people like him, Hawkins and many of the others, were learning to use these ships more as fighting units rather than fighting platforms. So they were using the big guns and would stand off, which, of course, eventually paid off in the great Battle of the Armada, where the big gun was dominant and the deck-to-deck was not done at all, partly because the Spaniards had twice as many men on their ships as the English did. What's a ship like this like? Well, you can see the castle, the forecastle here, knows the loopholes, fighting platforms, the beak of the ship here, also called the head, and any sailor knows what the head is used for, and that's what it was used for, among other things. Down below, you have the main gun deck, and that's where the big artillery were was mounted. Let's take a closer look at that. You have the guns. Incidentally, the men slept between the guns. They had no cabins except for a few officers, and they had no hammocks yet. Those came from Central America, a slightly later date. You can see where the anchor cables came in around the bits, their storage for the various supplies. You find wood stacked everywhere, the firewood, and down below the cable tier, which I mentioned already. In the aft end of the ship, you have the after castle, Drake's cabin. He was the only one who had any real privacy on the whole ship. This is the great cabin where Drake ate with his those people he selected to eat with him, to the sound of music, incidentally, on silver plates. He really knew how to be a captain. He could afford it, too. He'd had a very successful raid on Panama a few years before, and he was quite wealthy. The capstan, I think most of you recognize the capstan, the double capstan in this case, to haul on the heavy ropes, the heavy cables and ropes, for such as anchor, the anchors and the hoisting of the yards, their sails. You have here the stern chase guns in their separate gun room, and the main gun deck is here, as you can see again. And down below, you have the water storage. Of course, they preferred wine or beer. They thought it was better for them, and of course, they were right. Not for the reasons you think, but rather that the water went bad. And often it was just water. And then you have the dry stores, the various dried meats and salted meats and fish, the flour, and a few other. Think of how few things you can preserve for months at sea. And a major problem was keeping the crew healthy, which Drake did with great success on this voyage. There are no records of scurvy on this voyage, for instance. He kept getting people ashore, kept getting them fresh food whenever he could, and keeping the trips, the individual sections of the voyage, as short as possible. Down here is the ballast. Now, these ships had to carry a great deal of weight to counterbalance the press of the sails, keep the ship upright. Well, by the time Drake got the Golden Hind to California, he'd thrown most of his ballast overboard and replaced it with 26 tons of silver bars. That was topped with 80 pounds of gold, various chests of coins, jewels, and a few other little baubles of that nature. Also, four chests of Chinese porcelains, which we'll get back to in a moment, which he'd captured from a small ship off South America, Central America in that case. Anyway, there's the Golden Hind. We can get some sense of what she was like. We can find out something about how she was maneuvered. Something about the, you've got a fellow using a cross staff, how they were able to figure out where they were at sea. They could measure north or south reasonably well. They could not measure east or west in any meaningful fashion. Another look at the lower part of the ship, and here you have the steering arrangement. Here you're all familiar with the rudder and the tiller, but they did not yet have the steering wheel. So you have a long pole on a roller, working through a roller, fastened to the end of the tiller. So when the officers up here shouted down to the helmsman, who was steering pretty much by watching a compass, he couldn't see much, he would push this pole over, the whip staff, and that would turn the tiller, which in turn turned the rudder. Not terribly far. This ship was steered largely by adjusting sails. The rudder was the adjustment to the steering. So there are many, many details about these ships which are very useful to understanding what a square rig ship of that day could and could not do. What was the framework for Drake's navigation? And this study of Raymond Akers of the ships told us a great deal about that. And here you have a view of the normal rig of the Golden Hind, the six-sail standard rig of that time. And he had with him also a small craft, which would have looked something like this. Would have been about 35 tons, Golden Hind about 150 tons. These are capacity, these are storage capacity tons that they measured them by at that time. He abandoned that craft here in California before he went out into the far Pacific. Now, with that kind of background and a great deal of study of documents, it was possible to reconstruct the voyage. Now remember, he came through the Straits of Magellan, sailed up the coast of South America. He stayed ahead of the warning of his coming. He sailed right into Callao Harbor, for instance, the harbor of Lima. And nobody noticed that there was anything different. It was just another ship sailing in at dusk. And then he proceeded to cut the cables of all the ships in the harbor so they couldn't follow him. So before anyone even realized there was any problem, also picked up the knowledge about the treasure ship, which had left a couple of weeks before and wasn't going very fast. So anyway, once he goes north from there, he's finished his raid. He goes as far as southernmost Mexico at a place called Huatulco. There he's raiding mainly to pick up supplies for the next move that he intends to make. He can't go south. He can't go back through the Straits of Magellan. The Spaniards are waiting for him. He has to find another way to go home. And the way to go home, by the normal thought of that time, was to go around North America. So he also knew a great deal about the winds by that time. And he knew he couldn't sail any farther north. But he wanted to go around North America. So how did he do it? He took what's known now as a Spanish course. He went far out to sea on a bowline, as tight to the wind as he could get, to the northwest wind, went as up the coast to the north, northwest. Finally, when he got well north up here, he turned, tacked, and again on a bowline, pulls for that passage, which is supposed to be up here somewhere. There's that opening through the continent that everybody thinks is there. Well, he bumped into Oregon. The coast did not trend to the eastward, as they all thought, around Cape Mendocino. He was well north of Mendocino, and the coast is going the wrong way. The weather's going the wrong way. The winds are wrong. It's suddenly cold and nasty up there. This is late spring, and anyone who's gone up there knows that this is very much the condition up there. And we've tried that. We know about that. So anyway, he suddenly finds it isn't working. Now what? He identified the Oregon Dunes, described snow-covered hills. Well, you try that from offshore, it looks like snow-covered hills. You've got the trees growing out of them, it's hazy, and you've got that bright white shine, and this is exactly what it looked like to us, and that is not snow-covered hills. Captain Cook made the same mistake, incidentally. George Vancouver corrected him, finally. So, well, it was cold. It was a very cold year in the Little Ice Age. And so it was colder than today, and he hit that weather break up there near the border between California and Oregon, and his men were cold, wet, and very unhappy, and running into a coastline that they couldn't do anything about. So what to do? He did find a little shelter in a place called South Cove, Cape Arago, but that was not the harbor that he needed. It was enough to anchor in for a few days, hope the wind would change. Of course, it doesn't along this coast at that time of year. And eventually, he had to head south. Another run north would have wasted a great deal of time. And by this time, they weren't really thinking this would be a good idea. They also knew what the weather patterns were in the far Pacific, thanks to capturing all those charts from those various pilots and interrogating those pilots and paying them for their information. So he knew. He knew what needed to be done, and he knew the weather conditions were right to go to the Indies after this sojourn to the north. The typhoon season would be over, and the winds would be favorable. So he decided he had to go around the world. It was the only way to go home. In order to do that, he had to repair his ship, and South Cove was not the place to do it. So down the coast he goes, and any of you who've sailed this coast know it's a miserable coast. The onshore wind, rocks, pinnacles offshore, it's not a happy place for a square rig sailing ship. 300 miles of this before he finds a place where he can stop. Now, the accounts are pretty clear. He was at 38 degrees. Well, 38 degrees, you have to allow a little play in that, but 38 degrees is essentially where we are right now. So down the coast he goes, and thanks to George Davidson, we know a great deal more about these sailing conditions. George Davidson was a coast and geodetic survey man on the coast for half a century in the late 19th century. What he found eventually was an area of 38 degrees. This is not directly north-south. This is east-west, right across here, 38 degrees. Runs like this. So within the range of 38 degrees, you have Bodega, Tamales, you know about Tamales Bay, Drake's Bay, Bolinas, and San Francisco Bays. Five bays are within reasonable range of 38 degrees north latitude. Which one of those would prove to be Drake's Bay? And was that latitude really that accurate? Well, lots of research needed. I'm going to run you through it very briefly tonight, just show you a few of the high points. And we do have a book out here if you want to follow up a little more on that and some other materials, which we can talk about later on. One of the key clues was provided by ethnographers, Kroeber, Barrett, Elmendorf, and Heiser, the big names in California ethnography in the turn of the last century, were interested in this project, and eventually Robert Fleming Heiser wrote this book based on their joint research. And he determined, or they determined, that Drake had met the Coast Miwok people. Out of the 150 or so groups living in California, they were able to separate out one specific tribe and say, without question, that Drake met the Coast Miwok people. He could not have met any other Native Americans along this coast. This shows you how accurate the record keeping was by Drake's chaplain when he really wanted, was really excited about something, which he was in this case. He gave us those clues. So this book says it must be Coast Miwok territory. And that has been checked in more recent times by further ethnographers, and they all say Heiser and company had it right. Now, where is Coast Miwok territory? The same five bays. That's a really nice lockup to 38 degrees. This is, they're the Coast Miwok from the northern shore of San Francisco Bay up to past, a little past Bodega. One of those five bays. Well, there are lots and lots of other clues. One of them is the weather. For 14 straight days, they could not get the height of sun nor star. Sounds like Point Reyes to me. What it does not prove, actually, that it's Point Reyes. What it does prove is it could not possibly have been an inner bay. You know, Mount Tamalpais assures you that San Francisco Bay does not have such conditions in the summertime. Remember, Drake arrived on the 27th of June by our calendar. And so he's dealing with summer fog, and it must be coastal. That actually knocks out most of the possible bays. It really leaves only Bodega and Drake's Bay. The others are all inland in one way or another. But anyway, so that's just one more of many, many, many clues. And then there are islands. Now, how many island groups are there off the California coast? Entire Northern California, Central California coast, you have one group of islands, the Farallones. There is no choice. Now, on his way out of his harbor, he went to the Farallones. Okay, forget Bodega Bay. You can't see the islands from Bodega Bay, and Drake went to sea. He didn't go down the coast after he was finished working on his ship. He had no reason at all to go along the coast. He was going out to sea. So the northern bays, Tamales and Bodega, are impossible based on the islands. You can see how step by step this kind of research simply narrowed in on these on the eventual location. Then there are the drawings, the charts, drawn by a fellow named Dudley. Dudley was the son of the Earl of Leicester. He knew Drake. He was interested in long voyages of his own. He was a sailor. And Dudley, in, later in life, withdrew to Italy, changed his religion, and produced a great sea atlas. This is only one of three versions. This is one of the hand-drawn versions, which still survive, of Dudley's charts. And what do you have? You have two bays. One of them at about 38 degrees, one of them a little north, both with much more attention to detail than his other bays. And the southern one is marked as the place Drake landed, not the northern one, which is described as a bad bay. This is a good bay behind a great point. It has an inner harbor. It has good soundings to get into the bay, anchorage. There's a pencil-drawn line and a later correction in here, which shows that this is bigger than it was first drawn. This is the Gulf of the Farallones. Okay. It's not a little bay at all, but the Great Point and all these other descriptive words, there's an inner harbor, there's an outer harbor, This again reinforces that it's not Bodega. It's a second bay, which is Drake's. Bodega, remember, Tamales you can't see from the sea, and you can't get in even if you did see it. So another reinforcement to Drake's Bay. And this is what it looks like from the point of view of George Davidson, who was drawing the charts and the views. They did a lot of this in sailing ship days. They drew views. Drake did it, and sailors hundreds of years did it. There's normally vertical exaggeration, but this is what it looks like coming down the coast. Now, he's come down a rather nasty coast for 300 miles, and he's taken a look at Bodega Bay, and suddenly there's this big headland ahead of him. Well, what's he going to do? He has to round it. He has to get out to sea because he doesn't dare be embayed here with the northwest wind to drive him onto the beach. So, naturally, he goes out to sea around this headland to see what's beyond it. And the headland always has the possibility that there's something useful behind it. Let's take a look at that. Courtesy of the U.S. Navy, your taxpayer dollars at work, they lent us a destroyer one day to take a few people out to sea to take a look at Drake's Bay. So this is what it looks like coming down the coast. We came out from San Francisco on a day of absolutely perfect visibility, looking at Mount St. Helena from 70 miles away. We came out, ran past the Point Reyes head, turned around, and here we are coming back down on Drake's course, a little farther out to sea than Drake would have been, but same basic idea. And there's that massive headland coming up ahead, and naturally any sailor is going to be curious what's behind it. So as we close with the head, suddenly it falls away very dramatically. That's 11 miles to the main coast at that point. So what's Drake going to do? Of course, he's going to turn and follow around to see what's behind the headland. And here's Raymond Akers' painting of the Golden Hind with a little scouting vessel ahead. Remember, they're ahead. They're casting the lead, making sure there's plenty of depth. So the Golden Hind is safely tucked a little farther out to sea, a little deeper water, just to make sure. They go around the head to see what they will find. And this is what any normal sailor would do coming down this coast in circumstances like this. In fact, Drake's Bay is has noted as a harbor of refuge at any point except during a winter storm. And that's once you clear the head, Chimney Rock, 3-mile-long headland, and suddenly the white cliffs open up. Now, we had 57 people on the bridge of that destroyer that day. We went round the head. The first white cliff opened like that with a bright sunlight on it, and there was an audible gasp. I mean, everybody knew it was coming, and yet the surprise, nonetheless, of these brilliant white cliffs opening one by one along the shores of this bay. And remember, this is a sheltered area. You've got the headland, and then you have to run up a few miles to get into the bay itself. The wind and the seas dropped sharply the moment we turned the head, because that's 250 feet of cliffs and 500 feet of headland protecting this bay. We'd had white water over the bows going north, and in the bay it was very, very calm, as you can see here. Well, within the bay, you've got an opening. It's very visible. And remember, Drake had the advantage of the 50-foot or so high platforms up in the mast, the tops. So his people up in the tops could easily look in and see that, oh, yes, there's an opening, and yes, there's water in that opening, the entrance to Drake's Estero. What's he been looking for? He's been looking for a sheltered place to repair his ship and reprovision. And there are the great white cliffs. Those enormous white cliffs, 250 feet high. Now, these Englishmen were a long way from home, and what were they thinking about? Looks like home, doesn't it? Because these sailors have been up and down the English Channel. It's not just Dover. The whole southern coast of England has these long rows of these great cliffs. This is the Seven Sisters of Sussex in this drawing, in this photo, but it could be almost any place along the southern English coast where you've got these magnificent white cliffs. And the accounts show it. They were homesick, and they said so. It shows up in Fletcher's account. But there's much more. There has to be an entrance. Well, the Estero has a lot of water in it, which goes in and out twice a day. So there's practically always a deep channel. They had small boat, and they had the small accompanying ship, so they could easily send them in, sound this out, plenty of depth. It was sounded by an explorer 16 years later and found to be 16 and a half feet. And that's consistent, that has been shown in more modern studies too, that this channel tends to stay pretty much the same depth. And then within here is a deep water basin. So not very difficult. Come on in on the evening tide and take the Golden Hind into the sheltered waterway he's been looking for so long. There's much more of the story. Again, I'm only hitting a few high points. There's the inland. What is the country like? Drake was at first interested, of course, in repairing and resupplying his ship, but he also wanted to find out as much as he could about the country. And if you're down at Drake's Bay, you notice the channel in here, and you've got, there'll be a basin here, I'll show you in a moment. But there's also in the background, Great Ridge, Inverness Ridge. What's behind it? What's up there? And eventually Drake did take that walk. He took late in his stay, he took some of his men, and they took a trip up and over to see what was there. And this is Raymond Akers' reconstruction of that, up and over on Indian trails, over the ridge, to see what the country would provide. And if you're looking at Drake's Bay, you know the country out there. Most of you, I'm sure, have been out there many a time. And it's sere, it's dry in the summer. It is virtually no trees except in a few hollows. And windy, cold, wet, foggy. But what happens when you go in here? Well, just look out the window here. It's green. It's lush. It's startlingly different. The temperature's much higher. 20 degree difference? Yeah. Frequently, 15 degrees commonly in the summer of a drive, what we would do in a drive of 15 minutes. It's probably the largest change in climate in the shortest distance of the entire Bay Area. And here it is. All he had to do is go up onto that ridge, into that timber, down the other side, and he has the lush, green, very nice country that's described in the accounts. And then there are many other details. There are the great and fat deer, which are Roosevelt elk. There is a funny little critter called the coney. They called it a coney, a strange kind of coney, which turned out to be the pocket gopher, thanks to the research of Robert Allen, who's here with us today. There are birds. There are a lot of clues about the climate, about the plants, about the animals. Most of them don't really tell us a great deal, except it has to be an outer coast. For one thing, the birds are still sitting on their eggs. All the inland birds have long fledged, but the seabirds were still sitting on their eggs. This is important to the Englishmen. They were egg robbing. They were also batting birds over the head to salt them down. So they noted details like that.